Iran is a world event that's been impossible to cover without new media. When John Calloway died this week, it reminded me about the values of journalism that I hope will leap into new media and that John so cheerfully embodied. John Calloway was a longtime news director at Chicago's WTTW television and, I'll use a word he's not around to wince at now, a legend. He was 72. John hired me and fired me and always said that both times it was the best thing he could ever do for me. Your career doesn't begin when you get hired, he said. It starts the first time you get fired. You have to figure out if it's a career or a fluke. And he paused while his eyes, behind his thick glasses, teared a bit, as they did when he laughed or thought of something he loved, and said, I think you'll do fine. In a city where journalists are proud of being boisterous and pugnacious, John was known for being profoundly kind and pugnacious. He interviewed mayors, maestros, welfare mothers, Nobel laureates, and people who'd just been burned out of their homes in the middle of the night with equal consideration and grace. In these days when every citizen can be a reporter and editor, John Calloway might remind us why real journalism is a craft. It's easy to get people to watch, listen, and follow when the story's overwhelming and compelling, like today's drama in Tehran. But those days when the news isn't right in front of your eyes are important, too, because there are still millions of stories to be told, and the only way you get that chance is to build and earn a relationship with an audience who begin to trust that you can inform, amuse, move, and surprise them. Almost anything you may have heard on our show over the years that you've liked may trace back to something I learned from John Calloway. Be persistent. Be kind. Be fair. Try to do something different. Tip the bartender. Remember that it's a blessing to be a Chicagoan and a privilege to bring people the news. Last year, I came back to World Studios to be interviewed by John about a novel I'd written. The interview was emotional for both of us. John was effusive with praise. I had no premonition of mortality, but seeing him reminded me that the people you love do not last forever. I was happy he could meet my wife and children and see a book I'd written about the city we both cherished be successful. Remember, I told you you'd do fine, he said. If you hadn't left here, you'd still be running after fire trucks, falling down in snowstorms, and listening to low-rent politicians with me. Yes, I told him, and having a wonderful time.
And we sit in a bar and talk till two about life and love as old friends do. And we tell each other
Ann Hampton Calloway, you're listening to NPR News. Forget about War and Peace, Les Miserables, and Atlas Shrugged. The most time-consuming story ever told appears on the cover of the recent issue of Opium magazine. It's just 9 words long, but it'll take a millennium to read. Each word has been covered with different amounts of black ink that's supposed to gradually disappear over the next 1,000 years or so, revealing one word every century. Jonathan Keats is the author and designer. He joins us on the phone from Italy. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Is this a stunt?
The question of whether it's a stunt or a gimmick or something of the sort comes fresh to everyone's mind when they encounter a work like this, when really I think that what I'm after is quite the opposite. I'm after the sort of curiosity that we had as children, the sort of way of going about life saying, well, what if? What if a story took 1,000 years to tell? And what if it were a very short story at that? What would it be like? And what might it tell us about deep time?
Now, I'm looking at the cover right now. I mean, it looks like it's completely black, of course. And I guess I have to wait, what is it, about 100 years before I can see the first word, right?
Yes, it's a modest period of time compared to the 1,000, but you'll have to wait to get to the last one.
Did anyone at the printing press say, you know, Mr. Keats, we're proud of printing stuff that people can read, not that gets covered over?
Well, they thought that I was insane, which is not an unusual response. I had a long conversation with the printers trying to talk about the printing process and how it might be turned on its head, so to speak. Fading is, of course, something that is generally undesirable. You don't want the ink to fade, yeah, but it will. So my thought was to make that liability into an asset and to use the very process of fading as a way of bringing words out into view rather than having that be the mechanism by which a story vanishes from existence.
Are you the only one who's read this story?
No, the editor-in-chief has also done so, and we are, I believe, the only two people in the world who know the contents. Of course, neither one of us will survive for the full 1,000 years, so after about 100 years, no one will know what the story says. And that, I think, was partly also what interested me in composing this, was a story that would outlast the teller, a story that would outlast anybody who might engage it, and that would be, in a sense, something inherited by the next generation and the one following, and could only be apprehended and potentially appreciated in some sort of collective way over multiple generations.
Jonathan Keats, who's written the cover story of the most recent Opium magazine, but it'll take 1,000 years to get to the last word. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Congress took a dramatic step to fight global warming last night. For the first time, the House passed a climate change bill that could reshape the way we produce and consume energy. Here to walk us through the bill and its effects on the U.S. economy is Paul Krugman. Mr. Krugman, of course, is a Nobel Prize-winning economist who's also a columnist for The New York Times. Mr. Krugman, thanks for helping us out today.
Good to be on.
What would this bill actually accomplish if it passes the Senate? Give us the bullet points here first.
The main thing it's going to do is give people an incentive to take global warming into account when they make their decisions. What it will do is it'll put a price on anything that generates greenhouse gases by having a system of licenses that are bought and sold, so it's a market-based system, and that will percolate through. It means that all kinds of things that now might be on the borderline or not worth doing become worth doing because you get some extra savings from not having to buy as many permits.
So let me see if I understand this. Basically, the way it works now is industry can pollute, obviously, within the parameters of the existing law, but now it's going to be something that will cost them money.
That's right. You're some industry that's been emitting 100,000 tons of stuff we don't like into the atmosphere. You now get permits to emit 80,000 tons. If you're going to continue doing 100,000 tons, then you have to buy those extra permits. So you don't want to do that. And in fact, if you can cut it down to 60,000 tons, you can sell the extra 20,000 permits. So any way you look at it, there is a price part of your cost calculation about those emissions, which gives you an incentive to do less of it.
And this is called cap and trade, of
That's
course.
Right.
Is there any precedent around the world? Do we know if this will actually work?
Yeah, we have our cap and trade system ourselves for sulfur dioxide to control acid rain, and it's worked beautifully. The cost of reducing acid rain pollution has been much less than was expected. We have tradable permit systems for fishing, where there are limited resources of fish, and they work very well. So, no, this is actually a well-tested form. What nobody has ever done is done it on this scale.
And the goal is to cut greenhouse gases over the next decade by about 17% below where it was in 2005, 83% by the middle of the century. How is this all going to affect the U.S. economy?
Most of the estimates say less than you would imagine because the U.S. economy is a wonderfully flexible, innovative thing, and it can adjust to changes in incentives. So all of this is going to lead to probably a little bit less purchasing power than we would otherwise have. Congressional Budget Office says about $175 for the typical household by 10 years from now in losses, about the equivalent of a postage stamp a day. But in return for that, greatly reducing the chance of catastrophic climate change, reducing all of the negatives that come with it.
Now, it was a close vote in the House last night, 219 to 212. In fact, a lot of Democrats voted against it, 44 of them. Why is that?
Well, at best my count, three of them voted against it because they thought it was too weak. They were making a protest vote. But for the rest, look, this is going to have some inter-industry effects. Some industries will get smaller. There are parts of the country that rely a lot on coal. They're going to be hurt somewhat. Also, there's a lot of mythology out there. Although all of the serious economic analysis says that this is not such a bad thing, energy industries, the Republican Party, have been busy spreading horror stories about what it's going to do, and some Democrats, especially in swing districts, are afraid of that.
But do they have some point? I mean, you've just conceded that this will have an impact on some industries in the United States.
Oh, yeah, it's not cost-free. There are very few good things that are completely without cost. And it's entirely understandable that some people would prefer not to face those. And some interest groups that give a lot of campaign contributions will be hurt by this. So opposition isn't surprising. The miracle is that the thing passed anyway.
Paul Krugman, explain this to me. I heard Congressman Henry Waxman, who pushed through this bill, argue that it will actually create jobs. How will it do that?
Well, it's going to mean a lot of jobs in all kinds of industries that one way or another contribute to conservation.
Like which ones?
There'll be more wind farms built. There'll be people retrofitting power plants to reduce their emissions. There will be people weatherproofing housing and commercial buildings. What an economist would say is that employment will probably be just about the same as it would have been otherwise, but it'll be a somewhat different mix of jobs. And the main thing is that the cost to American households is going to be really minimal, and we might just save the planet along the way.
You willing to bet your Nobel Prize on that?
Which part? That it won't cost very much? I'll be willing to bet that Nobel Prize with no question. Whether it will save the planet is the question, because it might not be enough.
Economist, New York Times columnist, and Princeton professor Paul Krugman, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks so much.
This week it turned out that South Carolina's Governor Mark Sanford was not hiking the Appalachian Trail, as he'd suggested. Well, you know the rest of the story. He was really in Argentina, but it's another story. As it happens, another South Carolinian, R. Thomas Pierce, actually did go hiking on the trail to find out how the recession is affecting who's out there this year.
For the record, my friend Brad Wright is not a drug dealer, but his new nickname does suggest otherwise.
My name is Pusher, because my friend said I looked like a drug dealer because I was carrying around a giant bag of ibuprofen and calcium supplements the first day, and I was offering them to everyone.
His first day on the Appalachian Trail, that is. Everyone out here gets a nickname, and Brad, Pusher, is an old friend of mine. We grew up together in South Carolina. He's changed some since he started hiking in March. He's 26 years old and leaner now, with a dark beard migrating down his neck. I joined him for just a few days near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
Maine is 1,165 miles away, and Georgia is 1,013 miles away.
So you're not quite halfway?
Not quite, about 70, 75 miles to go, I think. As soon as we cross this river, I believe we're in Maryland. I think actually, let me check that.
He's right, it's Maryland. We hike for a few miles between the Gray Potomac River and the C&O Railroad track. Pusher the Backpacker used to be Brad, the office manager for a commercial real estate firm. When development slowed down last year, he started plotting an adventure in them there hills over the cubicle walls.
And I didn't put in my two-week notice until February of 09, so I was the only one left in the office by the time I quit.
Quitting your job, or even just putting it on hold during a recession, would be a non-starter for most. For one thing, hiking the length of the trail can end up costing a couple of $1,000s. But my friend Pusher, he's not the only hiker on the trail who's taking a risk to be here this year. Meet Couscous, so named because
I eat couscous with cinnamon and sugar, and somebody thought it was weird.
Every meal?
No, actually, just a couple of times. I haven't had couscous in weeks.
Couscous is Kim Morley, a 29-year-old environmental consultant from Atlanta. She says she's wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail for 7 years.
I really just had to make the decision to say, okay, this is the year that I'm doing it. And then it really wasn't difficult after that. May not have been the best time to take a leave of absence.
Couscous admits she's a little worried about being away from work for so long. Times are tough, and what if they forget about her way out here in the wilderness?
I send out emails from towns to a bunch of people, and, you know, I just copy my boss on it. So they know where I am, and so they kind of know I should be done in September at some point and back.
Also on the trail this year are the Duder and his dog.
And her trail name's Donnie. It's kind of like off the Big Lebowski, but she's out of her element.
The Duder, whose real name is Chris Lee, climbs the stony steps into Harper's Ferry. This is where the headquarters for the entire Appalachian Trail is based. When the Duder gets there, he drops his pack and sits on the hot concrete and gets Donnie some water. His girlfriend is coming to pick him up.
I don't see how people can get off for 6 months at a time.
What are you doing when you're not doing this?
I just graduated, so at this point, nothing.
He's 26 and wants to get into journalism. He says hiking the trail could be something of a resume builder, but then again,
there's never a good reason to be hiking senseless miles. I don't care what anybody says. And if you talk to any hiker, there's no good reason to be doing what I'm doing right now, especially the through hikers. I was talking to one old man one day, and he said, this is hands down the single most selfish act one person can do. Just leaving all of all of your people behind to worry about you.
But he sees an upside, though, too.
And I think if by doing something like this, hiking for long distances, you're somehow getting in better touch with yourself. It's all about individual perception out there. And ticks.
Internet access here. You guys expecting any packages here?
Inside, the headquarters is hopping with backpackers. Maps and guidebooks line the walls, and it smells, well, it smells not so bad considering no one's had a shower in days. Here, they can check email, charge cell phones, stretch out on the couch, and enjoy the electric foot massager. All through hikers get their picture taken here, too. The photos go in big black binders dating back for decades. Not much has changed over the years, other than the gear and maybe the haircuts. Many hikers do carry iPhones and Blackberries, but the trail continues to lure people who just want to get away from the world for a couple of months. What changes most is the world they're getting away from. Just ask Rusty Towery, a.k.a. Wheeler, a 26-year-old mountain biker from Georgia.
I was laid off in November.
What do you do?
Worked for Caterpillar, but great opportunity. I have no major responsibilities yet in life, so might as well do something like this now while I can instead of having to wait like the other half of the population on the trail, retired age.
It's true. The trail is generally split between 20-somethings and retirees. Wheeler says when he comes off the trail, there's a chance he'll already have a new job lined up.
I had a few things come about from the trail, people I've met.
I never really thought about the trail as a networking for a job.
Yeah, oddly enough, it's been pretty productive in that regard. Figured something good's got to come out of a hike like this. When I was starting off, I had friends that were going, man, I hope I get laid off.
As for my friend, Pusher, he packs his tent in the early morning before we part ways. He says he's not thinking about the economy or what he'll do after hiking the trail. He's taking it 1 mile at a time, and he has 1,000 more before Maine.
All right, man. It's good seeing you.
And he's off into unknown territory. When he emerges on the other end, there's no telling what the world might look like. Thomas Pierce, NPR News.
Don Quixote, Sancho Panza, Legs, you can meet more of this year's backpackers in an audio slideshow. Come to npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.